from the Johnson Space Center in Clear Lake to the Air Force Space Surveillance System Master Transmitter near Olney. If it's above, on, or below Texas, it's on. Pratt on Texas. Now, here's your mission director, Robert Pratt.
Visiting with our great friend Bob Zimmerman of BehindTheBlack.com, a renowned author and historian and science writer, and really one of the nation's top, I don't know, you know, the independent eagle eye, I guess, soaring up there, watching private space, government space, the space industry. And if you want to keep up with that, with what's going on in Boca Chica, Texas, with SpaceX and the entire industry, I mean, Bob's one of the original people with the clarion call about how government bureaucracy was destroying space exploration and how the private sector and competition is what makes it work, very recognized in that sense. This is the place to go. And one of the things that, of course, we follow a lot because it's happening here is with SpaceX. I mean, the Elon Musk has moved to Texas now. He's going to build some factories for his satellite deal down in Starlink down in the Austin area. Of course, he's got a Tesla factory being built in that area. SpaceX built the private spaceport down in, which I just love, private spaceport. Almost everybody else, it's leasing some government facility or taxpayers building it down near Brownsville. And then also, they have been testing their rocket engines the whole time in McGregor outside of Waco. Now, they've been working on this big lander thing, the Starship, and we've been enjoying watching the tests and landing it. That's just part of a system, I guess, that'll go on their really big rockets. You had an update on SpaceX's Super Heavy booster. Is that what the Starship's supposed to go on top of, or are they still developing a separate rocket for that?
No, Robert, let me explain the whole deal with Starship and okay. Super Heavy that they've been. So I've got a lot of posts on Behind the Black on this, and I almost have to try to I can't hold back because this is where the news is, but it does make my webpage sometimes seem to be SpaceX Central.
Well, they're the ones doing the work. They get the news because they're doing it.
It's the same thing with planetary research right now. Almost all my reports on planetary research right now is about Mars, and it's not because Mars is focused totally on Mars. It's because that's where the cutting-edge science is going on, so you report it. So anyway, so with SpaceX and Super Heavy and Starship, the original concept of this rocket was that it would have a first stage booster and an upper stage payload delivery system. And the booster, Elon Musk named Super Heavy, and it's essentially a big, I mean really big, version of the first stage of a Falcon 9. Basically, it will do the same thing a Falcon 9 first stage does. It will take the second stage off the launch pad, get it up to top speed, and then separate, fire its engines, and come back and land vertically. That's what Super Heavy is. It's basically the first stage of the rocket. Starship, his upper stage, he named it Starship, is essentially a SpaceX version of the space shuttle. It's essentially going to come down somewhat similar to the space shuttle, use its shape and body to come through the atmosphere as it, well, after it's gotten into space and delivered its payload, it'll come through the atmosphere using the shape to shed its speed so that it can slow down without burning up. And then once it gets close to the ground, it will, unlike the shuttle running on landing on a runway, the Starship will turn itself vertical and land, like Super Heavy and Falcon 9's first stage vertically on the launch pad. And they've done, as you mentioned, several different tests of that. So they've already done some very short suborbital tests of several different prototypes of Starship to make sure it could do that landing maneuver. It could also control itself as it's coming down through the atmosphere. And those tests have been relatively successful. They all haven't been perfect, but they're engineering tests. These are prototypes. If you blow them up, it's no big deal. You're learning how to build them. But they haven't yet until today, completed construction of or stacking of a Super Heavy booster. And my top report on Behind the Black now is that there is a link to an update of the assembly of the first Super Heavy booster prototype. Now, it's not yet completely assembled. It's now in two pieces, totally completely assembled. They need to stack them together, put those two halves together, and then they will have a complete super heavy booster, the first prototype. And it's the prototype. It's not the real complete thing. It doesn't have all the engines. The super heavy booster is going to have, depending on when SpaceX has announced what it's doing, they keep changing. This is their learning, but they can have anywhere from 28 to some 25 to 35 Raptor engines at its base. So this is apparently going to only have four engines, and it's basically this first prototype isn't going to fly. They basically are putting it together, and they're going to use it for engine tests and ground tests on the ground just to see if they can fuel it, unfuel it, if they can, you know, do a countdown with it, a static fire test with it, make sure the tanks will hold together under pressure. They're basically doing all those kind of tests. Once that's done, the second prototype, which is under construction right now, they're stacking it, that is expected to do the first hops. When those hops will happen, I think realistically will be sometime during the summer. SpaceX, however, has already admitted that it has an internal goal within the company to try to complete the first orbital test flight of the Super Heavy Starship combination rocket before the end of this year, and as early as July 1 is their goal. Now, they won't make July 1. Everyone knows that. They know that. But they're setting that as a date. I think that the first hops of Super Heavy will happen over the summer, and sometime in the fall, they might just try to do a combined hop of Starship and Super Heavy, which will go pretty high. It might not go into orbit first time, but it'll go pretty high. But they are, you know, this company pushes forward very fast. They don't waste aggressive.
You commented recently on, if you look at, for example, when they launched another set of these internet coverage satellites from Starlink, and that I think that was that the ninth flight and landing.
Oh no, it's no, the 20th. They've done.
No, I meant of that booster. The
oh,
other
of
day.
The first stage booster.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that and you were and you were talking about if you put all those together, just reusing the rockets, how much tonnage they've been able to put into space. You know, all of a sudden, it just shows what a joke it was. Everybody wanting to do the old Soviet model of having the bigger setup. It's more efficient. And some people have even said, well, what do they need the other four, the super heavy, if you can launch so many of these? Of course, I think that's because they're interested in taking enough material to the moon and things to be able to, and then refuel in orbit and things like that and go interplanetary. But it is shocking how successful they have been with their reusability that everybody else just kind of gave the back of the hand, oh, it can never happen, or it doesn't even make sense. Well, it doesn't make sense if you make your living off government contracts and you want massive fat in every single launch. But let's compare that tonnage and the work they've done and how they just build these. They just build these things to do what needs to be done. They don't care how funny they look, or, you know, they're making fun of their first Starship thing, calling it a water tank because it basically was a water tank. And then let's compare that with things that go on in government space. You had a piece on the Webb, James Webb Space Telescope, one of the greatest boondoggles of spending, along with SLS, in recent history, to the point that it's actually almost destroyed or hurt the very discipline that it's supposed to be launched to help.
Well, all right, let's first talk about that first stage of the Falcon 9. The Falcon 9 rocket has a first stage that's reusable. They actually reuse about 70% of the rocket. The upper stage is expendable. They can't get it back from orbit, so it burns up in the atmosphere.
They will someday.
The payload. But well, that's the Starship.
They'll just go pick them up and put it in the cargo bay, then bring it back down and redo the and reuse the.
They might do that. But that's first this record holding first stage. It flew just a few weeks ago on its ninth flight, and one of my readers commented on the website. You know, those nine flights took place in just 2 years. 2 years to do nine flights, and if you add up the payload on those nine flights, it's somewhere between 100 and 200 tons of payload that this one Falcon 9 first stage put into orbit. So think about that a minute. The cadence of SLS from the government, they don't think they'll be able to launch that faster than once every 2 years, and it can put up 75 tons. And in the cost is something like anywhere from, depending who you ask, $2 billion to $20 billion per launch. A Falcon 9 rocket costs SpaceX probably in the range of about $15 to $20 million per launch. And that same Falcon 9 rocket was able to launch more payload in about the same amount of time as a SLS rocket. Now, there's another component to the reusability that this rocket demonstrates. When you make it expendable, you don't really care if it fails, because you don't make it that reliable, because, you know, it only has to work once. But if you're going to make something reliable, you really have to make it good. It's got to work multiple times. And so SpaceX's rockets are much better built and much more reliable. You know, if they plan to fly it 10 times, you know that on its first launch, it's, you know, almost certainly going to work. And while SLS, which is only going to fly once, it'll probably work. But you know what? If it's only going to work once, the components could fail on that first launch. And that's what's been the history of rocketry till then. And now they're getting back to the web. James Webb Telescope was budgeted initially at $500 million, and it was going to launch in 2011. It's a government boondoggle of the worst sort.
That's a decade ago.
It's a decade behind schedule, and it's ending up going to cost $10 billion. That's 20 times the cost. And now, when it's launched, it will, if it works, provide magnificent astronomy for the world. There's no doubt about that. It is not an optical telescope. It doesn't replace Hubble. I must state that, because that's a lie that NASA sells all the time. It's an infrared telescope, so it looks in the infrared light, radiation that we cannot see. But nonetheless, it's going to do great work. But it hasn't launched yet. It's hopefully going to launch in October. And it's a total waste. It's been a total... as you hinted at, Robert, the cost of this, that $10 billion, wiped out the space astrophysics budget in NASA. They literally launched almost no other space telescopes in the aughts, and they launched almost none in the teens, and it's likely they're going to launch very few in the 20s, because there's no money for it. They spent it all on this, and they're now spending it on the next big boondoggle called the Roman Space Telescope, which is another kind of big project that's hopefully supposed to launch in 26. I guarantee it won't launch until the 30s, and it's going to end up costing multi-billion.
The what? Dollars. The Roman?
It's called the Grace, the Nancy Roman Space Telescope.
Oh, it's named after
called
somebody.
It was originally called the W-1st Space Telescope. It was proposed as a political game. I'm not going to get into that. It was definitely a game played by some political scientists, planetary astronomers, to gain their project and make their project occur. Well, NASA renamed it after Nancy Roman, who was the first chief astronomer at NASA and helped get the astronomy program going at NASA. And I think that's a fair, we should honor her. She was an important person in the early days of NASA in astronomy, and in fact was a key player in getting the Hubble Space Telescope built.
I just wondered why it was called Roman. I thought, what are they going to look for, Caesars in space, or, you know, the old Star Trek thing
Nancy
where you
Roman.
Had the togas on the other planet.
Yeah, no, and so the Roman Space Telescope, it's a big boondoggle. It's a shame because Nancy Roman will probably never get honored, because the thing will take decades to launch and cost billions.
Right.
And that's a real unfortunate thing. It would be much better to build smaller.
Right, lots of smaller
payloads,
useful ones.
You can get them up.
Yeah, and let me ask you real quickly. I want to get back to some of the things SpaceX is doing for Mars and things, but quickly, Biden has nominated former Senator Bill Nelson of Florida to be the next NASA administrator. Being from Florida, it's all about big space and government space programs. And, you know, just like the Richard Shelby in Alabama to keep the Huntsville area fully employed, not a fan of commercial space. But then in the last few years he was in the Senate, Bill Nelson began to, I guess, see the light on this. What are your thoughts on the aged Bill Nelson 78 years old, being the NASA administrator, it sounds like maybe they just wanted somebody as sclerotic as the president and as NASA to lead it.
Yeah, I think that's really the bottom line. Nelson was a big proponent of SLS and big space, government space, for decades. He was very much an opponent of commercial space. But he's a politician, so when commercial space started to succeed, SpaceX started to really pay off, he, like all politicians, jumped on the bandwagon and started to sell it. But so he could conceivably, be a proponent of commercial space. And, you know, politicians go where success is, and then they try to claim credit for it. Right. So commercial space is very successful. So he could do that. But more important is his age. He's about 78 years old. The last time I saw him live was during hearings in 2017. And I was really, he was then a senator still. And I was really somewhat appalled. His age showed. He was often confused at those hearings. He wasn't really aware of what was going on. He also seemed to be ignorant of the most recent developments in commercial space. And he really had trouble expressing himself on the very simplest topics. That was 3 years ago.
Birds of a feather flock together. I mean, he'll fit right into the White House.
Well, so what I think might be going on here is that the real people running the White House, because it's not Biden, he's somewhat, mentally weak at this moment. The people running things have picked somebody to take over NASA who they can then control, the bureaucrats can then control. That's not a good development. Now, the situation at NASA is there have been two camps at NASA for decades. One camp is very much into big space and controlling everything and doesn't want a private independent space program. They want to dictate terms and have NASA and all the money funneled to NASA. And the other camp is the one that wants private space, that wants NASA to merely be a customer and therefore get things accomplished. And up until it's about 2010, the first camp, the big space camp, was in control. That's why not much happened for 50 years after the landing on the moon. Since 2010, the private enterprise camp bureaucracy at NASA has been in control and has been able to bring about the renaissance we've seen. This is a question mark I cannot answer right now. Which camp will control Bill Nelson? Because I truly believe Bill Nelson is not going to be running things. It's going to be the bureaucrats.
Well, that's even when you have sharp people there, the bureaucrats try to run everything, and it's very hard not to let them. So, yeah certainly. Let's get back to you cover a lot of stuff. If you're a teacher out there, both higher education, so-called higher education, or secondary or even elementary, I will tell you, you can use BehindTheBlack.com. It's a very good resource. It's not all, just Bob and me with hard political opinion. Bob does put his opinion because he's an observer. But there is so much on the Mars rovers, things you can't even really find because he consolidates it. And plus, his cool image stuff could be great for any science class regularly. But a lot of stuff on the Mars rovers. But what caught my attention was a post on SpaceX narrows, is on March 18th, SpaceX narrows Mars landing site for Starship to 4 prime locations. These people really are working towards this goal. Talk about that.
Okay, well, I broke a story 2 years ago that SpaceX was using the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to get high-resolution images of several places on Mars where it was considering as candidate landing sites for Starship. They actually labeled them, the pictures they took, as Starship candidate landing sites. And I spotted those in the archive and immediately wrote a story about it. It got picked up all over the place. Well, there was a lunar planetary conference this week in which a group of scientists put up a poster where they detailed that they were actually hired by SpaceX to run a committee to analyze the pictures that there had been taken to try to narrow the locations for the best spots to consider. And so that poster announced that basically of the many pictures that have been taken in this particular region on Mars, they have now narrowed it to four prime locations and three backup locations. And I posted, I did this, very quickly, because it is a news story, and I include actually pictures of the four prime sites so you can see what we're looking at, and you can figure out, and links to them so you can see where on Mars they are and so forth. There's a map also to show where they are on Mars. And I've talked about at length of why they're picking these locations. It's in an area of Mars, a relatively somewhere around 40, 35 latitude, where there is ample, gigantic ample evidence of water ice, either close, very close below the surface. And some of the sites here, you'd be landing literally on what look like glaciers. Some of the sites would be out in what's on Mars, the northern lowland plain, so it's really flat. You don't really have glaciers, but you have strong evidence that right below the surface is what... on Earth is a water table. Here it's an ice table, a frozen layer of ice just below the surface. And in some places in this area, I've seen one report, one presentation by one scientist said, literally, you can stick a shovel in the ground, you'll hit ice. And so these are the prime sites. They're now in the SpaceX would have to do a lot of work to try to figure out how to land there safely. It's not going to be a prepared launch site, so you got to make sure you can land safe. And then how to utilize the site for the first humans to visit it. And so there's a lot of work to do, but nonetheless, SpaceX is very aggressively focusing in on getting the location where it wants to send that Starship ship. Because remember, it's the Super Heavy is the booster. Starship is the first stage. It will bring up as much payload as a Saturn V rocket and be reusable. It'll come back to Earth. But there will be versions of Starship that won't come back to Earth, that will go to the Moon and are planned to go to Mars, and it can bring a large payload, which means it can bring with it a very large habitable compartment within it that is protected from radiation and has all the materials it needs to keep people alive for a long time.
And it needs this water to be able to create fuel to get back. I mean, for people to come back. This is what people forget. They think about drinking and life. This is about water is needed to, with the hydrogen and oxygen, your oxidizer there to make fuel to leave a planet we go to.
Yeah, the water carries the oxygen you need for fuel. It carries the water for drinking. It carries it's essential. And so, yes, that's one of the reasons they're picking this location.
Okay,
and so they're not fooling around.
I want you to tell something that might be an update for people who, you know, really haven't heard anything since a science class when the evidence was at, when the things are outdated now, or it's been several years. Talk about the latitudes of the planet, where now it looks like there is water beyond a certain latitude and not towards the equatorial, but maybe China will find some. They're landing a new rover. Just to give everybody an update of sort of what we think we know now that we weren't real sure of before.
Yeah, one of the things people tend to think of Mars as a Sahara Desert. It's very dry, and most of the press seems to think this too.
Antarctica.
They're not up to date with the modern research. The modern research, the up to date research from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and I found this out in the last 3 years doing these many cool images from the orbiters. What they have learned is that on Mars, the only areas of Mars that are pretty much arid right now is the equatorial regions below 30 degrees latitude. Above 30 degrees latitude, moving towards the poles in both the north and south hemispheres, there's a 30-degree band from 30 to 60 degrees latitude, a band where you'll find numerous examples of glacial features. Lots and lots of glaciers. It's really the edge of the ice table of Mars. And as you move north beyond 60 degrees latitude, you increasingly get evidence of an underground ice table that's pervasive everywhere. And so, and then you get to the poles, which have gigantic, really very large ice caps of water ice. And so Mars is not a Sahara. Mars is an Antarctic desert. Antarctica is a desert. When you get that cold, it's dry. The air is dry. You can't have liquid water, but everywhere there's ice. So one thing that has to be understood about Mars is that a lot of the press will continually talk about how there's either no water or we've got to find the water. They found the water. There's plenty of water, accessible water on Mars. Right now, the real question is, at what latitude, how far south does that water, south, or how close to the poles does that water get? And
yeah, because you would rather land where it's a little bit warmer, but you got to find that sweet spot in either the southern or northern hemisphere. There was an interesting one of these, you know, endless numbers of things the press touted in the last few days. You know, they always tout this stuff out of just ignorance. It's shocking how bad some of the science writing is these days, but I read it somewhere about the new ideas that Mars's water didn't, you know, we were all taught, well, it had water and maybe oceans, but it all escaped through the thin atmosphere. Now they're saying, oh, no, maybe it didn't escape. Maybe there's a chemical process in Mars that's unique that bound all the water up into the soil to try to explain all of this. I don't know what the point of that was other than just another speculation. But the broader point of it is it confirms what we're talking about, that they're beginning to change their entire outlook. It's not that the water left Mars. It's just they're frozen under these, you know, you've got global dust storms covered by a thin layer of soil.
That report was basically talking about the long-term history of Mars, because in the dry equatorial regions, that band between 30 degrees north and south latitudes at the equator, there is no water presently, as far as we can tell. There might be
deep.
But what there is evidence of is that there once was liquid water. Now, the Mars climate is too cold, and the atmosphere is too thin for liquid water to flow. Water will immediately sublimate from a solid to a gas in that environment. So how do you get liquid water? And scientists have never been able to come up with any kind of climate model covering the whole history of Mars that would produce a period in the past when you would have had liquid water. They really don't have any model that anyone accepts that really solves this conundrum. Well, that report this week, the real point of that report was to suggest that a lot of the water that was thought lost wasn't lost to space, flown out the atmosphere. Instead, it got chemically trapped in the soil in minerals. Now, this is not water you can use. This is just water that's chemically hydrated, you know, like asteroids are hydrated. This means that they just have water molecules as part of their chemical structure, and it's very hard to get that material out. But what is more important is it's telling the scientists a little bit better overview of the geological history of Mars, and that, in the end, will allow them to try to figure out how to solve that more fundamental problem of how Mars was once maybe wet with water, liquid on the surface. That's the real point. And that will allow them then to understand the geology today much better, which will in turn allow them to better understand where to find the easily accessible ice that is on the planet.
Okay, and so then that brings me to the last little point I want to cover. We've got, of course, our new small pickup-sized rover on Mars. Our other old one's still going. There's so much exploration going on. China has got their rover, and aren't they landing it sort of in one of these spots maybe that's part of what they're trying to do, find out where the ice begins and where it stops, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly, Robert. What's going on is that the Chinese rover, which is still unnamed, is going to come down sometime in late May, early June. And it's going to land at about 24 degrees north latitude, which is just a little bit south of that 30-degree limit. As far as we know now, there is no ice below 30 degrees latitude. However, underground ice. However, that rover will carry with it, has on it, ground-penetrating radar, which will detect water under the surface. And that's one of its prime scientific purposes. It's going to see if maybe at 24 degrees latitude, if you can look below beneath the surface, maybe there is a remnant ice layer still. And that gets us close to the equator, where it's warmer, the climate isn't as rough, and it's therefore a better place.
I wonder, is the gravity well on Mars like, I'm not up on this stuff. I just know what it means and why it's easier to launch a rocket from closer to the equator of Earth than it is, you know, the Earth bulges out and you have less gravity there. Is that true on Mars as well, where it would be easier to be towards the equatorial zone to launch off of Mars to escape the planet, or is the gravity so weak? Well, no, it would still matter. I mean, it would still matter, even if it's weak on the amount of fuel you need.
Mars has about a third the gravity of Earth, a little more than a third of the gravity of Earth. So you don't need as much energy to get off the planet, but it also rotates at almost the exact same speed as the Earth. Its day is almost the exact same length as ours. And so that means if you launch at the equator, you're gaining an oomph if you move in the direction of the rotation. The rotation actually pushes you up and increases your speed, and you don't have to use as much fuel. So, yes, being near the equator is helpful, but that's not the main reason. The main reason is that at the equator, the extremes of temperature are not going to swing so far.
It's
very cold. The warmest temperatures they've ever recorded on Mars are somewhere in the range of 60 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit, but those are like super records. Most of the time, it's well below freezing everywhere by a lot. And so it's Antarctica. It's very cold. It's colder than Antarctica. But nonetheless, you get at the equator, you solve some of these problems. And so they want to get as low and find out. And once again, this is getting back to understanding the whole geological history. If you can know how far the ice has retreated from the equator, it helps you then gauge the overall history of Mars's geological and climate history. And they need to know this. And so that's the prime scientific mission of the Chinese rover. It will, of course, do other things. It's mainly an engineering test to see if China can do such an ambitious thing. But if they don't find water, that's actually a good result, because that'll help, once again, constrain where the ice is under the ground.
Well, and they've landed these small rovers on the moon, so they're taking it sort of like SpaceX does, except it's a big government program, but step by step, you refine the engineering, you get there, and let's hope there's lands, because the information it provides will be important to everyone. And if you read Bob's Encyclopedia of Space, we even in the height of the Cold War, with all these launches in the 60s, we were still sharing to some degree. Everybody was sharing certain amounts of data, whether it was the Van Allen radiation belts or whatever. We just didn't know about all this. And even when the Soviets went, you know, this was important information for everyone. And the same with the moon, photographs and other things. And we need all the information we can get. And as long as we stick with capitalism, real capitalism, not pseudo-capitalism that's really all military designed, as China does, we will win out in that. And we will have people there. We just have to keep these leftists out of the way of people like Elon Musk, which is, by the way, one of the big reasons he's moved so much to Texas. It's a more friendly governing environment in a better culture. Whereas, you know, who knows? I guess they'll keep the headquarters of SpaceX in Hawthorne, California for now. But it wouldn't surprise me later on, especially if there's not at least some temporary turnaround in California politics with this gubernatorial recall or something. It wouldn't surprise me to see him pick the whole group of them up and move them out of California. I have a piece today from, I don't remember the Heritage or whatever, but it details the large, you know, we've many, many small businesses, and these are substantial small businesses, moved to Texas and also to Arizona and some other places. But there's a really good piece that I have listed. It's called List of Companies. It's at the Center Square. List of companies leaving California grows, citing high tax burden, cost of living. And it says specifically that California Policy Center's cataloged at least 50 large corporations that have left California just since 2014, the vast majority leaving in 2019 and 2020. Goes in detail on that, and let's see what happens, because I would love to have a SpaceX headquarters in the Lone Star State. We just need to, you know, if the left can push all these racial, social justice and race theory training requirements, we just need a pro-liberty, pro-capitalism training requirement regularly for all the employees that move in too. And if we can get that done, we'll be okay.
It'll be
good. Let's end it on that, Bob Zimmerman. The website is behindtheblack.com. I use it every day, folks, behindtheblack.com. And while you're there, consider some of Bob's books. And if you're really interested in Mars, and you're really interested in just the idea of why humans explore, go take a go buy his download. It's very inexpensive. I think $4 or so at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other ebook vendors. It's called Pioneer. It's a book he wrote some time ago. And then just went and dusted it off and said, man, this is a good book. And I read it. I thought it was fantastic. And it's about why we explore, why we settled the West, why we settled the New World, what it is about humans.
It's a fiction book.
Right. It's a novel.
Make sure you mentioned it's fiction.
It's a novel. That's right. And it's very good. Well, I think it's just, you know, a science. You can categorize it as sci-fi if you want. That it is. But it's really just about what, it's just, that's the background of it, is humans have a need to explore and expand. And I love it. Pioneer. So it's at behindtheblack.com. Bob Zimmerman, again, thank you so very much for your generous nature with your time, my friend.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here, Robert. Anytime.
Thank you.
Log on to prattontexas.com.